Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Congressman Wiener comes clean, NATO strikes pound Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Libya, and wildfire rages in Arizona. In a tearful press conference, Anthony Wiener admitted that it was his picture and his fault.
To be clear, the picture was of me, and I sent it. I'm deeply sorry for the pain this has caused my wife, Huma, and our family, and my constituents, my friends, supporters, and staff.
NATO strikes hard at Colonel Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli, Libya. And a huge blaze spreads in Arizona. Here's Fire Information Officer Jim Wilkins.
The talk I'm getting at the mess hall and the chow line and stuff is this is one incredibly difficult fire to fight. If they use words like, never seen anything like it, or it's a monster, or things like that, you kind of got to listen.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, coming to you this week from the studios of WBFO in Buffalo, New York, with Margaret Sullivan of the Buffalo News, Nancy Cordes of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Wiener's admission, turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa, American heat wave and wildfire. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in Buffalo this week is Margaret Sullivan. She's editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News. Margaret Sullivan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
We're in Buffalo to meet with public radio listeners of WBFO and WNED. And with us from Washington is Nancy Cordes, the terrific congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point.
Why, thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And hello, Jack. Glad to have you right there.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Nancy.
We've got a lot to look at this week. Let's step back right off the bat to that press conference on Monday. A tearful Congressman Wiener, Democrat of New York, admitted to lying repeatedly about sending a lewd photograph to a woman over Twitter last month and said he'd had inappropriate exchanges with several women online.
Over the past few years, I have engaged in several inappropriate conversations conducted over Twitter, Facebook, email, and occasionally on the phone with women I have met online. I have exchanged messages and photos of an explicit nature with about six women over the last 3 years. For the most part, these communications took place before my marriage, though some have sadly took place after.
And the marriage, less than a year old, and officiated over by no less than former President Bill Clinton. Democrats, well, Republicans very critical. Democrats not happy either. On NBC's Today Show yesterday, Democratic Congresswoman Alison Schwartz of Pennsylvania called on Congressman Wiener to step down.
As a member of Congress, as a woman, as somebody who was appalled by this behavior, the right thing to do is for Anthony Wiener to resign.
Nancy Cordes in Washington, what's the temperature there? He has appeared pretty adamant. Can Congressman Wiener hang in there, hold on to his job?
Well, I think right now he thinks that he can hang in there. So far, by our count, about 10 Democratic House members have come out publicly to say that he should resign. That's not an enormous number. They've been away on recess this week, so we'll see what happens when they come back next week. But there's a new poll out from his own district in New York where 56% of his constituents say that he should stay in office. Only 33% think that he should resign. And after all those images that we unfortunately saw this week and the lewd email interactions, if they're still saying that he should stay in office, it may be that he's gotten through the worst of this, and if he just keeps his head down, he can stick through it.
Boy, I don't know. We're here in Buffalo. Margaret Sullivan is editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News. And in your backyard, Margaret, you've got a kind of precedent here on the Republican side of the ledger. You, of course, famously had House Member Christopher Lee emailing a shirtless photo of himself. He was out. You've got a Democrat in that seat now.
That's right. It's been an interesting contrast to see how quickly Chris Lee resigned. Really, the story arc was so short. And to see Wiener hanging in is quite a contrast.
Why do you think that was? What was the about that moment in time? It was a shirtless picture. This is shirtless pictures and lewder from Anthony Wiener. What do you think was different about that time or that man and this?
Well, it's hard to say, although there was speculation that there was a great deal more to come, and by resigning, he was able to short-circuit that.
Put a stop to that. Now, of course, Catherine Hochul has won that seat. That got a lot of attention because she hammered on Republican positions on Medicare. She's now not quite calling for Anthony Weiner to go, but she's saying ethics commission.
She is, and she's, you know, she's been harshly critical of the behavior, as easy to do, but has stopped short of calling for him to resign.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this? Here we go again in one way, and this a very prominent Democrat. I mean, this was a guy who loved the limelight and was very strongly spoken in it.
He was, and it comes at a bad time for Democrats. You mentioned the Buffalo race, the Hochul race. That had given the pendulum had seemed to swing back to the Democrats. They were on a roll, at least of publicity and of self-confidence. We have an issue, Medicare, it's working, let's all pay attention, and now this comes along. Someone made a list the other day of 16 of these scandals in the last, I think, 10 years. And the people on the list, there were Democrats, there were Republicans, there were governors, senators, congressmen, all different offices, different parties. They all shared one thing in common. They were all men. And for whatever reason, and of course one large reason, is the pool of women politicians, prominent offices, so much smaller. This doesn't happen, or it hasn't happened in anything like that degree to women office holders. And I suspect that one upshot of this flow of sexual misbehavior on the part of male politicians is going to be a rise in women's acceptability in office. Already polls show that voters think women are more money honest. I think this is also going to say, if you don't want to be disgraced waking up in the morning, vote for a woman.
Nancy,
hallelujah.
What do you say?
That's the best thing I've heard all day. And I do think that, you know, next week when members of Congress come back, that'll really be the test. Next week will really be the test of whether he can stay in office or not, because they're going to come back and they're going to want to be talking about policy issues. And everywhere they go, they will be asked about Congressman Weiner, which will be tremendously embarrassing, particularly the leadership. Steny Hoyer, Nancy Pelosi, they've kept a pretty low profile this week. They will be asked about it next week. They will have to take a stand one way or the other, whether they think that he should resign or whether they think that this is more appropriately handled by an ethics investigation, which, as you know, usually goes on and on and on. And that will really determine whether he can ride this out. But you mentioned that he talked to Bill Clinton, who he considers a mentor, obviously a very close friend of his wife's. And Bill Clinton is the poster child for riding out a scandal like this, you know, and if he gave any advice to Anthony Weiner, one would imagine that he would say, keep your head down, you know, keep doing your job. And, you know, Bill Clinton, 10 years or so after his embarrassing scandal where he was impeached, is beloved in many corners of this country.
And yet we had a blue dress, not a photograph or a series of photographs, and some getting just about as intimate as they can be. I mean, the notion that Bill Clinton officiated over their wedding, and now Anthony Weiner's wife, who seems a remarkably laudable, bright woman, Huma, working side by side with Hillary Clinton. It almost looks like Hillary Clinton may be giving her some mentoring on this. She's certainly been around this track. Margaret Sullivan with me here in Buffalo. Here's a Facebook message from Ashwin, who says, please remind me again why a public servant's private life, especially his peccadilloes, is news and reason for chastising him. What do you say to that?
Well, it's news because we expect some level of decorum and behavior from our elected officials. And this just doesn't meet the
standard.
Not hitting
on college students on Twitter with pictures of your underwear.
Exactly.
With you in it.
Exactly.
Or him in it, excuse me.
And worse.
Of it. And what about the gender question mark? You've been around the track. You've seen men and women and in power. I mean, how do you interpret this?
Well,
Anthony Weiner is not a fool, and yet he seems to have acted like an utter fool.
Women, I think, in politics are generally less embarrassing than men. So there may be some truth to, and it's interesting to see that the two candidates who ran for the Chris Lee seat were both women, Jane Corwin and Kathy Hochul. So there
may speak to Jack's observation.
Exactly.
Voters may want that kind of calmer hand, less quick thumb on the Twitter button, I don't know, of the woman. Jack Anthony Weiner was a big spokesman for the progressive left in the Democratic Party. He was right out front. Who takes his place? Or, you know, does he therefore stand as a particular stumbling block for the Democrats looking to try and scratch back ground in the House in the upcoming elections?
Well, I think he is a stumbling block. I mean, he did have great credibility. He was witty. You know, and politicians are self-mocking, witty, come up with lines. They get on TV all the time. And he made, you know, stout fights for the public option and for, indeed, even for single payer. And I think
on health care.
And I think his presence really eclipses the progressive caucus. You know, in all the budget talk, no one has mentioned or hasn't gotten much mention that the progressives have their own budget. And if you look at it, it looks like a pretty good blueprint for the future. Higher taxes on the rich, more investment in schools, cutting back on defense spending. It's a plausible path, and yet no attention, and he's one of its figureheads, unfortunately.
Nancy, high profile, but not apparently particularly well-loved in some of Democratic quarters.
Right. I think he was often resented for taking a lot of oxygen out of the room, perhaps speaking out on behalf of issues that he hadn't particularly worked on and stealing some of the limelight from the people who had. On the other hand, as Jack alluded to, what he did so well for the Democrats was that he was attacking the president on a fairly regular basis from the left. You know, the Republicans attack him all the time from the right. And what Anthony Weiner would do is say, hey, don't give up on the public option. How dare this president give up on the public option? And what that would do was put pressure on the president when he was trying to move to the right, trying to strike that bipartisan compromise, put that pressure to say, hey, we're watching what you're doing. You can't go too far.
It also brought him emails and tweets online from female supporters saying, you go, Congressman, and they got answers from this congressman, maybe more than they bargained for. Nancy Cordes in Washington, Margaret Sullivan with me here in Buffalo, New York. And Jack, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Anthony Weiner's scandal, mounting violence in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya. Newt Gingrich's staff bails out. Heat wave and wildfire in Arizona. We're broadcasting today from the studios of WBFO in Buffalo, New York, visiting a member station and listeners there. Joined today by Nancy Cordes of CBS News. She covers Congress in Washington. Margaret Sullivan is with us, editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News. Jack Beatty's with us, and I want to get to calls on Anthony Weiner. Buffalo, New York. Bob is calling. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. There's a huge generation gap here. To a younger generation, photos of a shirtless man or a man in his underwear, it might be scandalous to an older demographic, what I choose to call the fuddy-duddy generation. But to a younger generation, these people are sexting photos to one another. They're having
hey, Bob. Sex. Bob, he's a congressman. He's sending photos.
Sex is not that big a deal. It's not that big a scandal. And besides, everything's coming down on Representative Weiner. Nothing much is being said about Senator Vitter, Senator Ensign, Senator Coburn. Those guys broke some laws, you know. So what's the double standard here?
What's the big deal? I mean, of course, a lot has been said over time about those guys. And, I mean, even here, Bob, with the younger generation, you call it fuddy-duddy, but in younger generation terms, I mean, he's sending photos, you know, of his junk here. I mean, this is about as out there as you can get. That's not too much for a congressman, Bob?
I think in 20 years, all these kids today, and I'm no kid, all these kids that have all their pictures out there on the internet, there's going to be a lot of answering to do in down the road. I mean, all these congressmen are complaining. They probably have kids who have naked pictures out there on the internet as we speak, and those chickens are going to come home to roost.
Hey, Bob, I appreciate your call. Margaret, I don't know. Now, 20 years from now, going to be a bacchanalia out there, everybody with everything online. It is interesting. In Queens, the surveys, the public polls in Queens are saying, let him hang in there. Let him go to try to be reelected.
So far, his constituents are hanging in there with him. But, you know, those kids may be sending pictures of themselves over the internet, but they're not members of Congress, and I think that's a difference.
Jack, what do you think here? Is it fuddy-duddy to look at this stuff and say, wait a minute, even say, he should go?
I don't think so. I see his point, though. This is becoming more common. This is a sort of frontier offense, you might say. But that doesn't change the egregiousness of it and the egregiousness it achieves by publicity. You know, we know too much. We see too much. It, as you say, there isn't just a blue dress. There are these odious photographs. And, you know, the piece in the Post today says, well, is there really a case for ethics investigation? And people say, on the one hand, no. On the other hand, but there is that standard of, does this reflect creditably on the House? And there can't be a person in the country who thinks it does, that it does anything but besmirch the reputation of the body.
Let's go to Jason in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Jason. What do you think on Anthony Weiner?
Well, thanks for taking my call. My point is that it's obvious he should resign. He's disgraced his office. There's already poor trust in faith in the Congress. I feel like one of the things that was missing in the story, I don't know if you guys have brought this up, but he did allow for Andrew Breitbart to be accused of potentially being the hacker that sent these photos out.
This is the conservative crime. Blogger and, who first raised the flag. Yeah.
So I don't have any doubt in the world that if Andrew Weiner could have allowed the blame to be placed on Breitbart, he would have. It was only when his hand was forced did he apologize, and he really didn't give a very good apology to the person that was probably the most wronged in the whole story, which was Andrew Breitbart.
Yeah, there's no question. I don't know about most wronged. Well, the public will decide on that, but he certainly lied. He admitted that he lied, and he lied in a way that made Andrew Breitbart look like a liar when, in this case, he was not. I appreciate your call, Jason, saying time for him to go. Let's get one more right here. Iowa City, Iowa. Don, you're on the air, Don.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, yes, I guess I'm one of the fuddy-duddies, and I think maybe Mr. Weiner brought a share of disgrace to Congress. But in the last 10 years, we've had congressmen that have been supporting a war we were lied to by giving tax cuts to the wealthy. And, you know, this is far more egregious to me than what Mr. Weiner has done.
So lies and bigger lies out there, a sense of proportion around this. But do you think, Don, when you put it in that context, should he go or not then?
Well, if he goes, I would like to see somebody like Paul Ryan, who allegedly is courageous for this new Medicare plan, who for 10 years or so supported a war with tax cuts for the wealthy.
Don, we hear that loud and clear. It's interesting, Nancy, you start throwing people out of Congress these days and there may be no end to it.
Oh, exactly. And your caller was right that there are people who have actually broken the law who have stayed in Congress. Senator Vitter of Louisiana was implicated in a prostitution sting. And not only did he stay in Congress, but he's since been reelected. Senator John Ensign, who was being investigated for paying off the family of his mistress to the tune of $96,000. He was being investigated by the Department of Justice. He stayed in office for a year and only stepped down last month because some embarrassing details in this Senate ethics investigation were about to be made public. I do think that it would be much more difficult for Congressman Weiner to keep his seat if he came from a more conservative part of the country. But we've interviewed many of his constituents in Queens, and what they have all basically said, almost unanimously, was we think what he did was disgusting, it's reprehensible, but he didn't break any laws, he represents us very well, and we think he should stay.
We've got the whole range of responses online here. What we've got here, Pacaruso says it is not his private business. A leader in a large nation must be beyond compromise and coercion. Simple as that. Holly says, why should Weiner resign when Senator Vitter is still in office after being listed on the D.C. Madam's client list? Prostitution is actually illegal. Holly writes, it's going to be an interesting ride for Anthony Weiner if he can hang on through the storm that's in front of us right now. We've got so much more on the political front. I want to turn to some of it. There's Newt Gingrich and his top staff. There's Tim Pawlenty and his new his speech this week on the U.S. economy and where that might go. Here's Tim Pawlenty. This is on Tuesday, the GOP presidential candidate, former Minnesota governor, speaking at the University of Chicago. He laid out his plan for economic recovery, proposing large spending cuts that go further than any plan currently being considered by Republican leaders in Congress.
We can start by what I call the Google test. If you can find a service or a good available on Google or the Internet, then the federal government probably doesn't need to be providing that good or service. The post office, the government printing office, Amtrak, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and others were all built for a different time in our country and a different chapter in our economy. When the private sector didn't adequately provide those services, but that's no longer the case.
And there you are. Look on Google. Anything you can find there, why have it in government? Jack Beatty, what's being articulated here by the mild-mannered former governor from Minnesota?
Well, he's been mocked on this Google line. I mean, people are saying, well, click on Social Security, for example. But I think other people are saying, well, that makes some sense. The world is changing. Why can't government change with equal rapidity? But what's striking about it is about his plan is the scope of his tax cuts. He has essentially three times the Bush tax cut is one estimate of what this his tax cuts would be. He would cut taxes for millionaires and billionaires, according to one estimate, by at least 41%. That'd be a 50% cut in the corporate taxes. There'd be a complete elimination of the estate tax, capital gains, tax on income. And, of course, all this would necessitate draconian cuts in domestic spending, including in Medicare and Social Security. And it would vastly increase the deficit unless there was this miracle growth. You know, he has raised, I think, the issue of the campaign, growth. How do we get growth going? So he deserves points for that. But he has a fantasy picture of averaging 5% growth over a decade. That hasn't happened in U.S. experience since the early 1960s. And it's interesting, the reviews he's gotten from Republican economists and people who have, you know, worked for Republican administrations. One called this plan impossible. Another, Reagan's former budget director, said he just doesn't see the numbers here. So there's a skepticism even among his constituency, even among the Republican economic intelligentsia. And I wonder why he's done it. And I think one reason is that he is really in a desperate straits there in Iowa. He's fighting against Herman Cain. I mean, he's down in the polls to Herman Cain, who is a dynamic speaker, entrepreneur, but who is in no sense a serious candidate. How unserious is he? Well, just 2 weeks ago, it came out that he had in his campaign account $13. And yet he's resurging in parts of Iowa because he turns the electorate on with his, you know, his one-liners. He says we need a leader in the White House, not a reader. He wants to have bills that are 3 pages long. This is catching on, and Pawlenty is just desperate to get attention. This plan, which essentially would, you know, cut taxes for everybody and reduce the whole domestic spending radically, this plan is his bid to get that attention.
Nancy Cordes, how do you interpret it? The same way Tim Pawlenty is taking out this hard, deep, deep cut and grow position. What do you think? If he promises 5% growth, is that a glittering promise to an electorate? What about fellow Republicans looking at this position?
Well, I think that all of the candidates and would-be candidates are fighting right now to capture the imagination of the Republican electorate, and in particular the Tea Party, because that's where a lot of the excitement and money is right now. And this is really mana to members of the Tea Party, which is still really shopping around and hasn't really settled on one particular candidate. Of course, members of the Tea Party like to say it's a movement, it's not a party, so everyone is free to believe in who they want. But I think that, you know, whoever does capture their attention, whether it's Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain or Tim Pawlenty, is going to reap dividends from that. And even if 5% growth is completely unrealistic, even if the kinds of tax cuts that he's proposing will never be enacted, if it works with the Tea Party, then he could get a lot of energy from that.
Margaret Sullivan, here you are, editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News in Buffalo, New York, a city that, like many others, could certainly use, you know, some growth and economic recovery.
That's right.
What do you think is going to resonate with the electorate? Is it this message of cut government spending to the bone and deeper and that will spark it? Is it bring on more stimulus? Is it kind of sit tight and hope for the best, which Ben Bernanke sounded like this week? What do
That's
you think?
Right. Well, you know, in this area, there's no more important subject than the economy, and I think that's true throughout the whole country, and it's still a question of it's the economy, stupid, as we go into yet another election. And so I think that the Obama campaign will be very challenged on this subject. People are disenfranchised about the whole way that things have played out, and it's a way to get attention, and I think it may well capture people's imagination.
That is the deep cut government, and hope that does it.
Yes, I don't think it plays particularly well in New York State, which is very blue, and here, you know, which is, it's a very Democratic area. But I think throughout the country, it will.
People scratching their heads and wondering what to do. Nancy Cordes, can you please give us some explanation for what's going on with Newt Gingrich? He came out with a big, you know, a trumpet blast a few weeks ago, immediately kind of stepped in it, and now people bailing out, his whole top tier of staff bailing out of his campaign. What's going on?
Right. We're hearing as many as 16 aides, which would make up the bulk of his top campaign staff. Apparently, they just didn't get the sense that he was serious. You know, he went off on this long cruise in Greece. And I guess from what I've been able to gather, they were making plans while he was away for how he was going to embark on his campaign when he came back. And he had a very different vision. And I think what's really notable here is not just the number of people who left, but the fact that even his spokesman, Rick Tyler, who has been with him forever, years, even he walked out, which indicates not only that they thought that he wasn't serious about his campaign, but that, you know, there was something more going on here that really really disappointed them about what he was doing.
And
of course, some of these workers are already hooking up with new campaigns.
Right. Is the Republican field effectively down one as of today, or do you think he can bounce back, hang in?
Well, he insists. He put out a release to the effect last night that he plans to keep going and that he's going to debate on Monday and that he's going to go to other events. But how do you conduct an effective campaign if you have no campaign staff? And I think that this is something that will completely turn off anyone who would have given money to his campaign. So it's really difficult to see where he goes from here.
Hard thing to have hanging around one's neck. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Jerry. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Hey, I would just like to comment real quick with what Jack said about Herman Cain not being a serious candidate. But even though he said he had $17, whoever said he had $17 in his account, but it was just like one-liners with we need a leader, not a reader. Now, if I remember correctly, then candidate Obama, it was yes, we can. It was turn the page. It was it's our moment, it's our time, and fired up, ready to go. So, I mean, I really don't remember any specifics that then candidate Obama used except the ones that were under his energy policies that the energy would necessarily skyrocket. And
hey, Jerry, do you think then that Herman Cain is or may emerge as a serious candidate? This is the entrepreneur, former CEO of
yes,
Godfather's Pizza.
Yes, I really do think he can emerge as a serious candidate. He's got a very good message. He doesn't talk in circles. He answers directly. And I think a lot of people in the news media would be scared to death of him, especially if he ever got to debate the current president, because the current president wouldn't know what to say without a teleprompter in front of him. And Herman Cain.
Hey, Jerry, we got it. I don't know. I've seen Herman Cain rattle on. I've certainly seen Barack Obama rattle on any number of subjects, and not always with a teleprompter by any means, but I take your point. Jack Beatty, yes, we can. Is that all you heard in the Obama campaign? I mean, hope.
There was a lot of that, unquestionably, but it had behind it, you know, years of involvement in public life. It had behind it books that he wrote himself, at least one book on public policy. It had behind it a stellar education at Harvard Law School. I don't know anything about Mr. Kane. I'm sure Mr. Kane is educated as well. The point is, there was a lot, too. If the issue is substance, I don't think there's any question but that Barack Obama has a lot of intellectual substance. But I saw Herman Kane deliver his speech before 15,000 people in Atlanta, his announcement. That's really something. He's firing people up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Congressman Weiner called Bill Clinton to apologize for his scandal. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart had a field day.
The congressman had a sex scandal and had to apologize to Bill Clinton? For what? Copyright infringement?
Apple guru Steve Jobs emerged from medical leave to unveil his company's latest next big thing, the iCloud.
We're going to demote the PC and the Mac to just be a device. And we're going to move the digital hub, the center of your digital life, into the cloud.
And the Bonnaroo Music Festival in Manchester, Tennessee opened Thursday. Here's singer Karen Elson last night.
You've got to pick up every single chair. Beat this out to make it rich. Oh, no.
There we are. We're looking at a week in the news. The Anthony Weiner scandal, mounting violence in Syria, Yemen, Libya, Newt Gingrich's staff bailing out, heat wave and wildfire in Arizona. Margaret Sullivan, editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News, is with us. We're in Buffalo, New York today, broadcasting from the studios of WBFO, member station here. Nancy Cordes is with us from Washington, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty's with us. Just a couple more from online here. Brad from Texas talking about, I guess, Weiner still says it's dumb and childish, very tween. And yet, Brad writes, he's not in bed with Wall Street. He's not for policies that cost me my pension. In short, I agree with his politics, so let him stay. We'll see. On Mitt Romney, skipping the straw poll in Iowa, Gary in Davenport says, I went to the straw poll 3 years ago, was credentialed by the Romney team. Long story short, Romney won the ISP 3 years ago. McCain didn't even go. I think the straw poll is a dinosaur, has no relevance except for an excuse to get some free barbecue. Meanwhile, abroad, we've got all kinds of violence and action in North Africa, in Yemen, in Syria. NATO moved in on Muammar Gaddafi's compound this week and bombing it much more extensively than ever before midweek. Libyan leader got on the air afterward in a live audio broadcast, vowing not to surrender despite heavy NATO bombardment of his compound in Tripoli.
I am now speaking as planes and bombs fall around me, but my soul is in God's hand. We will not think about death or life. We will think about the call of duty. We will not surrender. We will not give up. We have one option, our country. We will remain in it till the end. Dead, alive, victorious, it doesn't matter.
All of NATO arrayed against Muammar Gaddafi, and Muammar Gaddafi still shaking his fist from Tripoli. Got more interesting in Brussels. In Europe today, U.S. Defense Secretary, outgoing at this point, warned that NATO, even as it was going heavy on Gaddafi this week, risked becoming irrelevant if the United States partners in the organization don't start pulling their weight. Here's Secretary Gates.
There will be dwindling appetite and patience in the United States Congress and in the American body politic writ large, to expend increasingly precious funds on behalf of nations that are apparently unwilling to devote the necessary resources or make the necessary changes to be serious and capable partners in their own defense.
11 weeks into the Libyan campaign, and already, said Secretary Gates, European NATO partners turning to the U.S. for munitions. Nancy Cordes, what do you make of this juxtaposition, those images of lots of explosions in the Gaddafi compound, heavy NATO attack there, and at the same time, Bob Gates saying this organization may soon be irrelevant?
Right, and I think when he said that patience in Congress might be dwindling, it has already dwindled. The House voted last week by a large margin to basically rebuke the president, saying we don't understand what our mission is in Libya. We don't know if we want to continue to commit troops. And there is a real frustration that when you say NATO, really what you mean is the United States, that the United States is really carrying the lion's share of the burden, that this is not being shared among a number of countries. And I think that Secretary Gates was saying, look, Europe, NATO was just a given for decades, but the sentiment in Congress right now is obviously against spending enormous amounts of money on missions like this. There's a lot of war fatigue in Congress, particularly when it comes to Afghanistan. And if the member nations don't stand up and participate, then even this Libya mission could be in jeopardy.
Jack Beatty, we'll turn to Afghanistan in just a moment, but what about NATO and the Libya example? I mean, in some ways this week it looked like, you know, NATO trying to give it a big final blast in the hopes that he would get the heck out of there so they could get the heck out of there. But here's Bob Gates looking well beyond Libya and saying, you know, even at a time when the West is being challenged economically, certainly, like never before in anybody's lifetime, NATO itself, the, you know, military alliance at the heart of it, may just drift away.
Well, you know, you could argue that its purpose disappeared with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that ever since it's been an exorbitant anachronism. If you just turn back the clock a little on this, I remember in the late 60s, Mike Mansfield almost getting a majority in the Senate for essentially cutting the U.S. commitment to NATO drastically. In the 80s, Gary Hart, running for president, said, "We're not the Romans. When we go someplace, we don't have to stay there forever." This was in the 80s with the Cold War still on. And now the Cold War is over. Now there and meanwhile, we have been carrying these nations, carrying their defense burden, while, as everyone points out, they have their welfare states, they have their state-paid university tuitions, they have their vacations and so on, while we have been holding it up. You know, there's a line from a British statesman around the turn of the century talking about the British commitments, and Lord Salisbury said, the weary Titan staggers under the too vast orb of its fate. Well, here we are, the weary Titan holding up all these alliances. And I think I think Secretary Gates is looking over the horizon of this is coming. I mean, there's got to be a reckoning with this with NATO and with its, you know, with the way essentially we've been carrying NATO.
Atlas with that planet on the shoulders. Yeah. Atlas not looking so buff these days, no. and the planet looking pretty gnarly. I want to look at this, Margaret Sullivan, what you see in public sentiment here. I mean, this extends beyond Libya and NATO right to Afghanistan. That was hot again this week. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a confirmation hearing Wednesday for Ryan Crocker. This is President Obama's nominee to be the next U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. And during that hearing, Republican Senator Jim Risch of Idaho described his difficulty in justifying the continuation of the war in Afghanistan to his constituents.
People back home keep asking me, what's going to happen? How's this going to end? What kind of progress is being made there? Certainly militarily, we've done well, I believe. But beyond that, this is very, very difficult. And to articulate what our objectives are, and what our goals are, and how this is going to end with us achieving those is very, very difficult to grasp.
Ryan Crocker, who we know from time in Iraq and now President Obama's nominee for ambassador to Afghanistan, in return warned of serious risks if the U.S. abandoned its mission in Afghanistan.
It will go on being hard, but hard does not mean impossible. As Secretary of Defense Gates has noted, we walked away from Afghanistan once in 1989 with disastrous consequences. We cannot afford to do so again.
Margaret Sullivan here in Buffalo. The U.S. walked away after the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan. Up came al-Qaeda. We know what followed later. That, of course, is a scary mantra to repeat. On the other hand, this is 10 years and counting. It's a lot of money, billions every week. How do you read public sentiment on this commitment?
I think people are torn. There's a great deal of patriotism, and there's the aftermath of 9/11. People really wanted to see America be strong in that wake. And at the same time, if there's war fatigue in Congress, there certainly is in the public as well. And the fatalities, the casualties, and the expense has really gotten to people.
Nancy Curtis, are you counting votes in Washington this week? Is this a serious question or just, you know, chagrin that we're hearing?
I think it's very serious. I watched that entire hearing with Ryan Crocker. It was the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, so a committee that is more well-briefed on this war than perhaps any other. And every single senator, Republicans and Democrats, expressed grave concerns about our mission there. You had Senator Kerry saying that our commitment in troops and in dollars is neither proportional to our interest nor sustainable, in my judgment. In other words, even if we make progress now, even if we conduct nation building there, once we leave, it's all going to fall apart. And then you even had Senator Webb, a former military man, saying if there's any nation in the world that really needs nation building right now, it's the U.S. It's not Afghanistan. And that's where we're putting hundreds of billions of dollars.
So there's this immediate question. This summer, there's supposed to be some drawdown. And the issue is, it 5,000 or maybe 10,000? This is the sort of the Gates terrain. Does it go higher up to the 30,000 who were put in for President Obama's surge? What do you hear?
Well, I think that the president is making that decision right now. And so he's facing pressure from Congress to withdraw more quickly. And then he's facing pressure from Secretary Gates to withdraw more slowly. So I think the big test is going to come in July when U.S. security forces, U.S. troops, rather, hand over control to security forces that have been trained there in Afghanistan in seven major provinces. And I think the way that they handle that, now the U.S. troops won't be leaving altogether. They'll still be there as backup. But the way that they handle that, I think, will be the key for the president to decide just how quickly he can draw down troops.
And then there is Syria, with reports of quite distinctive violence this week, reports. And now Syrian forces headed up to that town in the northwest where reportedly security forces were killed. Fear of some imminent big crackdown there. And there is history around this kind of thing in Syria. Syrian state television claimed that 120 members of the Syrian security forces were killed by so-called terrorists in the northern town of Jisr al-Shagur. In response, troops have been sent to the town. Anti-government demonstrators and many local residents say the government's account was a lie, that the only people killed were defectors and innocent civilians shot by Syrian troops. Here's one resident of the town.
We don't want the army to come in. Our youth has been killed. I lost four of my cousins. My first son is injured. My second son is injured. My cousin is dead. We've had enough of the paramilitaries.
Jack, this is an ominous military advance on the town where the government alleges so many of its own security forces were killed.
Yes, and as you say, it has a precedent in the, I think, 1982. President Assad's father did essentially level the town of Hama, the city of Hama, killing thousands of people, and something like that at a lower scale of atrocity seems to be brewing right now. And a diplomat quoted in the Financial Times said everyone is buying into the fear of what comes next. That is to say, Western powers are thinking, well, do we really want this guy to go? Because after all, he's keeping this place together. But then the diplomat went on to say this should not paralyze action. Well, it is paralyzing action. The French say they're going to submit a resolution to the Security Council condemning Syria. It doesn't look like it would pass. The Russians say they're probably going to veto it unless there's some just such a horrendous atrocity coming up that even the Russians can't duck it. But quite off the page, just think what's going on here. Soldiers are saying we won't fire on our own people, and they're doing that and getting shot for it and knowing they're going to be
shot. Is that happening in Syria, Jack? I know it did in Egypt. We all do. But is that happening in Syria?
I have seen accounts over the last couple of weeks that it happened in Dera, and people are alleging that it happened here.
But let's be clear, a lot of people have been shot in Syria, and apparently by soldiers, if the video we see is any proper evidence.
Oh, indeed. I'm not. I'm doing is saying that the soldiers are showing, as are the civilians, a degree of civic courage that I think is probably one of the most inspirational things on the planet today. You know, a decade ago, there was a report from the UN by Arab intellectuals essentially saying the Arabi was just a total civic waste. People were, resigned to their fates living in these despotisms. They had no, political energy or creativity, no feeling for liberty. Look at that. Look at those cliches. Look at how all that has come down.
They fall down.
Yes, and how these people with no chance of standing up, soldiers are saying, we're not going to shoot on, some are, we're not going to shoot on civilians. Civilians are standing up against tanks. This is happening in the name of freedom and dignity.
Jack, I want to get callers here. Mike in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi. Well, what do you know?
Well, I can tell you, Tom, that the attitude of the Afghani people, I've been there, dealt with them face-to-face.
When you in look the at U.S. People, Armed Services, Mike? Have you been in the Army there?
Yeah, I'm in the Army. So, you know, and you look at the Afghani people and they look at you with contempt and spite and anger. They're just as war-weary as we are. They've been at war much, much longer than we have, and they just don't want us there anymore. I really feel like our job in Afghanistan has really come to a close, and, you know, I'm ready to get out of there as well.
Mike, your attitude may be calling the tunes soon. I'm not sure about that, but there's a first-hand report from the front. What do you say here, Nancy? I mean, this is a broad swath of the world. We haven't even come to Yemen, where there's all kinds of crisis. Is the U.S. here going to be in a situation where it has to kind of double down or move out of the way? These are many challenges all in one tight time frame.
I've definitely heard Mike's sentiment echoed on Capitol Hill. Senator Risch, you played a segment of him earlier. He went on to say, you really wonder if they want what we are trying to give them. And if they don't want it, we shouldn't try to give it to them. I think that most people in Congress understand the stakes, that either you double down, you keep pouring money into it if you want to have any kind of impact, or you pull out, that half-hearted involvement is a waste of money. And so I think the question now for a lot of members is which one is in our national interest? And I don't think that there's any easy answer.
Margaret Sullivan, in a word, as we move into this 2012 campaign season, which theme do you think is going to resonate more? Dig in, stay in these tough scenes, or pull back, ease off?
I think pull back and ease off, absolutely. People are very tired of it.
And it has cost a lot, and it has gone on a long time. On the other hand, it is the world. It's real, and it's out there. It's going to be something to watch. Margaret Sullivan, editor-in-chief of the Buffalo News, it's been great to be with you at WBFO in Buffalo here today. Thanks so much for coming.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News in Washington. Always great to have you, Nancy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
See you back in Boston. Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.